Are you awake, Louis?
Morning, Nessus. Have you been flying all this time?
Some hours ago I turned that chore over to Speaker. You will notice that we have already traveled 7,000-odd miles.
Yeah. But it was only a figure, a tiny fraction of the distance they would have to travel. A lifetime of using the transfer booth network had ruined Louis's sense of distance. Look behind us, he said. See that dust trail? Any idea what it might be?
Of course. It must be the vaporized rock from our meteoric landing, recondensed in the atmosphere. It has not had time to settle out of so large a volume.
Oh, I was thinking of dust storms. Taj forever, look how far we slid. For the dust trail was at least a couple of thousand miles long, if it was as far away as the ship.
Sky and Earth were two flat plates, infinitely wide, pressed together, and men were microbes crawling between the plates.
Our air pressure has increased.
Louis pulled his eyes away from the vanishing point. What did you say?
Look at your pressure gauge. We must have been at least 2 miles above our present level when we landed.
Louis dialed a ration brick for breakfast. Is the air pressure important?
We must observe all things in an unfamiliar environment. One never knows what detail might be crucial. For instance, the mountain which we chose as a landmark bulks large behind us. It must be even larger than we thought. Again, what of that silver shining point ahead of us?
Where?
Almost at the hypothetical horizon line, Louis, directly ahead.
It was like searching out a single detail in a map seen edge-on. Louis found it anyway. A bright mirror gleam, just large enough to be more than a point. Reflected sunlight. What could it be, a glass city?
Improbable.
Louis laughed. You're too polite. It's as big as a glass city, though, or an acre of mirrors. Maybe it's a big telescope, reflector type.
Then it has probably been abandoned.
How so?
We know that this civilization has returned to savagery. Why else would they allow vast regions to return to desert?
Once Louis had believed that argument. Now, you may be oversimplifying. The ring world's bigger than we realized. I think there's room here for savagery and civilization, and anything in between.
Civilization tends to spread, Louis.
Yeah. They'd find out about the bright point anyway. It was directly in their path. There wasn't any coffee spigot. Louis was swallowing the last of his breakfast brick when he noticed two green lights glowing on his dashboard. They puzzled him until he remembered switching Tila and Speaker out of the intercom last night. He switched them back in.
Good morning, said Speaker. Did you see the dawn, Louis? It was artistically stimulating.
I saw it. Morning, Tila.
Tila didn't answer.
Louis looked more closely. Tila was fascinated, rapt, like one who has reached nirvana.
Nessus, have you been using your TASP on my woman?
No, Louis, why should I?
How long has she been like this?
Like what? Speaker demanded. She's not been communicative recently, if that is what you mean.
I mean her expression, Tangit.
Tila's image, poised on his dashboard, looked at infinity through the bulk of Louis's head. She was quietly, thoroughly happy.
She seems relaxed, said the Kazin, and in no discomfort. The finer nuances of human expression.
Never mind that. Land us, will you? She's got plateau trance.
I do not understand.
Just land us.
They fell from a mile up. Louis endured a queasy period of free fall before Speaker gave them thrust again. He watched Tila's image for her reaction, but he saw none. She was serene and undisturbed. The corners of her mouth turned very slightly up. Louis fumed as they dropped. He knew something about hypnosis. Bits and oddments of information such as a man will collect over 200 years of watching Tri-D. If only he could remember. Greens and browns resolved into field and forest and a silver thread of stream. It was lush, wild country below them, the kind of country flatlanders expect to find on a colony world. More's the pity.
Try to put us in a valley, Louis told Speaker. I'd like to get her out of sight of the horizon.
Very well. I suggest that you and Nessus cut yourselves out of autopilot and follow me down on manual. I will land Teela myself.
The diamond of flysickles broke up and reformed. Speaker moved port and spinward toward the stream Louis had spotted earlier. The others followed. They were still dropping as they crossed the stream. Speaker turned spinward to follow its course. By now he was virtually crawling through the air, moving just above the treetops. He searched for a stretch of bank not blocked by trees.
"The plants seem very earth-like," said Louis.
The aliens made noises of agreement. They rounded a curve of stream. The natives were in the middle of a broad section of stream. They were working a fishing net. As the line of cycles came into view, the natives looked up. For a long moment, they did nothing more than let go of the net while they stared upward with their mouths open. Speaker, Louis, and Nessus all reacted in the same way. They took off straight upward. The natives dwindled to points, the stream to a winding silver thread. The lush wild forest blurred into green browns.
"Put yourself on autopilot," Speaker ordered in an unmistakable tone of command. "I will land us elsewhere."
He must have learned that tone of command, strictly for use in dealing with humans. The duties of an ambassador, Louis mused, were various indeed. Teela had apparently noticed nothing at all. Louis said, "Well?"
"They were men," said Nessus.
"They were, weren't they? I thought I might be hallucinating. How would men get here?" But nobody tried to answer. Chapter 12. Fist of God. They had landed in a pocket of wild country surrounded by low hills. With the hills hiding the mock horizon and the glow of the arch drowned by daylight, it might have been a scene on any human world. The grass was not precisely grass, but it was green, and it made a carpet over places that should have been covered by grass. There were soil and rocks, and bushes which grew green foliage and which were gnarled in almost the right ways. The vegetation, as Louis had remarked, was eerily earth-like. There were bushes where one would expect bushes, bare spots where one would expect bare spots. According to instruments in the scooters, the plants were earthly even at the molecular level. As Louis and Speaker were related by some remote viral ancestor, so the trees of this world could claim both as brother. There was a plant that would have made a nice hedge and or fence. It looked like wood. But it grew up at 45 degrees, sprouted a crown of leaves, dropped back at the same angle, sprouted a cluster of roots, rose again at 45 degrees. Louis had seen something like it on Gummidgee, but this row of triangles was glossy green and bark brown, the colors of earth life. Louis called it elbow root. Nessus moved about within the little pocket of forest, collecting plants and insects for testing in the compact laboratory of his scooter. He wore his vacuum suit, a transparent balloon with three boots and two glove and or mouthpieces. Nothing of the ring world could attack him without piercing that barrier. Not a predator, not an insect, not a grain of pollen, nor a fungus spore, nor a virus molecule. Teela Brown sat astride her flycycle, with her larger than delicate hands resting slightly on the controls. The corners of her mouth curved slightly upward. She was poised against a flycycle's acceleration, relaxed yet alert, setting off the lines and curves of her body as if she were posing for a figure study. Her green eyes looked through Louis Wu, through a barrier of low hills, to see infinity at the ring world's abstract horizon.
"I do not understand," said Speaker. "Exactly what is the trouble? She is not asleep, yet she is curiously unresponsive."
"Highway hypnosis," said Louis Wu. "She'll come out of it by herself."
"Then she is in no danger?"
"Not now. I was afraid she might fall off her cycle or do something crazy with the controls. She's safe enough on the ground."
"But why does she take so little interest in us?"
Louis tried to explain. In the asteroid belt of Sol, men spend half their lives guiding single ships among the rocks. They take their positions from the stars. For hours at a time, a belt miner will watch the stars, the bright, quick arcs, which are fusion-driven single ships, the slow, drifting lights, which are nearby asteroids, and the fixed points, which are stars and galaxies. A man can lose his soul among the white stars. Much later, he may realize that his body has acted for him, guiding his ship while his mind traveled in realms he cannot remember.
They call it the far look. It is dangerous. A man's soul does not always return.